Hey folks, today's episode was sponsored by Datadog. It's a cloud-scale monitoring and analytics platform. Datadog was built to bring clarity to complex dynamic applications in the cloud, on-premises, in containers, or wherever they run. With beautiful dashboards, distributed tracing, and seamless integrations with more than 200 technologies, including Azure and Docker and PagerDuty, Datadog provides deep end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of modern apps. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. I'd like you to try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial today. Listeners of this podcast will also get a free Datadog t-shirt. Get started at bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Steve Sanderson. He's a senior software engineer on the ASP.NET team at Microsoft. Full disclosure, I also work on the ASP.NET team. Although Steve and I don't work directly together, we have known each other for a long time, and he worked on or wrote Knockout.js, which you may have used in the early days of JavaScript. And doesn't Knockout power a lot of the Azure portal?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's been used since the third iteration of the Azure portal, which has been around for a few years now. It's the current iteration. And yeah, I'm pretty certain it's the biggest Knockout application in the world. It's had hundreds of developers working on it, and it's still holding together. So yes, that's pretty cool.
Well, that's got to feel good. And that certainly is proof that you can ship software and put it into production. So today we're going to talk about Blazor, B-L-A-Z-O-R. But what is Blazor?
Blazor. It's a experimental project that we're doing within the ASP.NET team to think about what the future of .NET as a client-side web application platform could be. Because this year, the WebAssembly standard is now available in all mainstream browsers, and that creates some pretty exciting new possibilities for how you can write software and deliver it through a browser. And so we got thinking, can we put .NET on WebAssembly? And if we could, what sort of applications would people write? What would the programming model look like? Could this be really productive? What sort of tooling would we do around this? You know, how could the whole concept of .NET application development be reborn for the browser? You know, obviously Silverlight existed a few years ago and was an example of .NET in the browser, but that was based on plugins. Now plugins are not really viable in the modern world, but WebAssembly is very viable. WebAssembly is the modern way of delivering all kinds of applications that are not written with JavaScript into a browser. And so we're excited about the possibility of doing .NET development that way. And Blazor is an attempt to build an application framework that uses those technologies. And at this stage, it's not a committed product, but we are very much hoping, some of us on the team are very much hoping, that it will become eventually a committed product that people will be able to build production .NET applications with.
Okay, so there's a lot I want to parse and take apart there. So let me kind of break down a couple of precise questions so I can get an understanding here. So back in the day, when you wanted to do something the browser didn't support, when you wanted to run native code or you wanted to run your own stuff or just generally break the rule, you'd install a plugin. And wasn't there a thing called NSAPI, or like the Netscape way of attaching native things to browsers?
Yeah, that's right. Plugins have been around for longer than I've been doing any software development. Like plugins are a very old concept, for sure. But they were not really viable as of the whole move to mobiles. As some people claim that Apple is largely responsible for killing plugins because they, you know, Steve Jobs was so adamant that Flash was never going to run on iOS, and their mechanism for ensuring that was to not have any way of doing plugins. And given that, you know, considering how many people have iOS mobile devices, it's not really viable to ship a product that depends on that. And I don't know if that really is the thing that shifted the industry, but a lot of people claim it. And in any case, the net result of whatever has happened is that modern browsers don't allow plugins of that kind anymore.
Well, and then there were some security concerns.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because the plugin doesn't run necessarily in a sandbox, in a formal sandbox. I mean, they were in-process DLLs that ran within a process that was managed by the browser, but there was always this idea of native code that could do evil things.
Yeah,
so I know absolutely. That was a concern. Yeah,
I mean, the minute you install a plugin, you're trusting a third party to protect your machine against running third-party code. And it's a very, very hard problem to solve. And browser makers spend a huge proportion of their time trying to keep this sandbox robust. And when you start bringing third parties plugins into it, it is very, very difficult to guarantee that security. And I think in practice, the security didn't turn out to be that solid.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing was that when a browser didn't do what we wanted it to do, we, the community, used plugins as a way to make our own virtual machines. Like we had Flash, we had Java, we had Silverlight, all as a way to break out of that sandbox, for lack of a better word, and then build on top of that and have plugins of their own. You could almost look at it as a Flash file as a plugin to the Flash plugin, as a plugin to the web itself. We were building ecosystems on top of plugins that were themselves virtual machines.
Yeah, that's right.
So what is WebAssembly then? Is WebAssembly a solution to the plugin problem, or is it something more?
Yeah, so WebAssembly is not a way of changing the sandbox that the code runs inside. A lot of people, when they first hear about WebAssembly, developers immediately run around with their arms in their air shouting, it's going to cause terrible security issues because people are running machine code inside a web page and we can't protect ourselves against that. But that's not what it is. And that's not a problem that is triggered by WebAssembly. Anything that is running under WebAssembly is within the same browser sandbox. So what WebAssembly actually is a specification for a bytecode format. So it's a format for machine instructions that's quite a low-level format, hence the name WebAssembly. It's not regular assembly. It's not x86 machine code or any other specific instruction set that runs directly on the CPU, but rather is an instruction set that's more like the instructions for the Java virtual machine or the Microsoft Intermediate language for .NET. So it's a more high-level, low-level language, if that makes sense. And then the browser is going to take that and it's going to execute it. And it does so by just-in-time compiling that to the real machine code format of whatever machine it's actually running on, in exactly the same way that it does for JavaScript. So when the browser downloads a normal JavaScript file, it can interpret it and stepping over each of the instructions in the original JavaScript text format. And to some extent, browsers do that. But browsers also just-in-time compile parts of the JavaScript for better performance to machine code. And they do that after having run certain verification checks to make sure that the code is definitely only going to do things that are absolutely known to be safe. And then they have this process for generating machine code that is definitely known to not step outside the sandbox in any way at all. So that works well as a way of speeding up JavaScript. But I suppose a number of years back, people got this idea of, well, if we're going to JIT compile this stuff anyway, why are we starting from JavaScript, which is a super high level language, and it's expressed in this very inefficient human readable text format? What if we had a more low-level bytecode format that expressed just a smaller set of instructions, and we expressed it in an efficient binary format, and then we use the same rules to JIT compile to sandbox-compliant code, could we then compile to that bytecode format from other languages? For example, could we take some C code and compile that to the WebAssembly bytecode format, and then the browser in turn receives that and executes it at much, much faster than you would normally be able to execute a high-level language, because it's starting with this low-level bytecode format, which JIT compiles to machine code, and then that can hopefully execute very fast while still being within the same security sandbox that JavaScript runs in.
Is WebAssembly like assembly in that it's moving things around registers and doing low-level things on a virtual CPU?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So, and if anyone's seen MSIL, the assembly format for .NET, it's extremely similar to that. It's also a stack-based virtual machine. So if you read the code, which you hopefully never need to do, but if for whatever reason you do end up reading some WebAssembly compiled code, you'll see that most of what it's doing is pushing stuff into a stack and popping stuff off a stack and then doing instructions that operate on the top items from a stack. So to add two numbers together, it's going to have one instruction that pushes the first number onto a stack, the second number that pushes the second number onto the stack, and then it will call the add instruction, which adds together the top two numbers on the stack and adds the result onto the stack. And then you'd have another instruction that gets it off the stack and so on. So that's just what it keeps doing all the time. And from that basic primitive, you can build up normal logic that you implement in higher level languages.
Okay, so we don't have to worry about the sandbox, and we know that the browser's JavaScript kind of universe has been hardened because JavaScript has taken such a front seat in the last few years that everyone is focusing on it. So we're building on top of a thing that's already well thought of and already well managed. But how many layers, like how many, you know how they say it's turtles all the way down?
Yeah.
You're saying we're going to take C# and compile it in IL and put that into a DLL and then run that on a virtual machine, which runs on a browser, which is its own. Like, do we worry about layers or do we revel in the idea that we don't have to think about the underlying computer anymore?
Yeah, well, I guess there's pros and cons. When you have more abstraction, that often creates a high-level program environment that can make developers more productive, but at the same time, you have to balance that against the need for runtime performance. And so WebAssembly is an attempt to create the right level of abstraction where you can compile from an arbitrarily high-level language to some instruction set that itself can be executed very efficiently. So yes, there's quite a lot of levels involved, but by the time you get to WebAssembly bytecode, you're only one JIT compile step away from native machine code. And the idea is that the specific WebAssembly instructions that exist can be modeled very efficiently on the kind of CPUs that exist today. So generally, people claim that WebAssembly code is more or less equivalent to native performance. So if you have some C code that you compile to regular machine code and execute it directly, or you compile it to WebAssembly and run it under a browser, then the performance is going to be more or less comparable, not exactly equal. Maybe there's going to be a factor of two difference or something like that. But when we're talking about a single constant factor like that, that's probably not going to change the kind of software that you write. If it was a, you know, orders of magnitude difference, then that would be a big deal. But a smallish factor like that, you can still write the same kind of code. So when we take an even higher level thing like .NET and compile it, there's two different ways that we could execute that .NET code. The most obvious way that people usually assume that we're doing is that we take the .NET code and we convert it into WebAssembly, and that's the end. And that would probably produce the most efficient runtime performance that we could get. But that's not what we're doing right now in Blazor. In Blazor, we are running the .NET code on an interpreter, which is itself implemented in WebAssembly. And the reason we're doing that is because it produces a very, very nice development experience, because it means that you write your C# code and you can compile it to normal .NET assemblies using your normal .NET build process, which is very fast. You know, even a moderate-sized application can be built in like 1 second, more or less. And then every time you make that change, you do your 1 second build, you refresh in the browser, and you carry on, and you get a very nice fluid development experience. But eventually, when you want to go into production, it might be worth going through a bigger build process where you actually compile all the way to WebAssembly code. And that's a thing that we haven't implemented yet in Blazor, but we do have an actual plan for doing that, and that's underway. So that should produce better performance at the cost of spending more time building your application.
Mm-hmm. Let me back up a couple of steps just to make sure that I understood something and that the audience understood it as well. When I was describing kind of the conceptual stack as being deep and implying that there's possibly concerns or, you know, unspecified concerns around perf or whatever. I felt like what you said really explained a lot to me. Like just because the conceptual stack is quote unquote 10 deep doesn't necessarily mean that that is representative of a call stack, nor is it representative of 10x performance. Like you just said, we're going to collapse this all the way down to machine code and it's going to get executed pretty darn close to the metal. And that conceptual stack was there for a number of reasons, but not at runtime effectively.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And my hope is that most developers who are writing logic in C# are not really thinking about anything apart from their C# logic. That's the thing that you focus on. You know roughly what the performance characteristics of different C# code is, and that it will be reflected in the reality of your application. You don't have some new special rules for the fact that it's on WebAssembly, because the actual eventual set of instructions that the CPU is executing is not that different from what it would have been under normal .NET desktop runtime.
Hmm. Okay, so then that gets to the, you know, at this point in the podcast, there may be someone who made it this far who's like, yeah, but why don't you just learn JavaScript? Why are you doing this? And it seems like the answer is because C# makes us happy and because .NET is an enjoyable environment, and maybe this could be something that .NET developers would enjoy doing and be productive doing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I personally aspire to see the day when web development expands beyond its current scope a little bit. I think web development has certainly come a long way over the last 15 years or so, but it's still a very constraining kind of development environment. Software developers building web applications are much, much more limited in their choices of a technology than developers building desktop apps or mobile apps or games or embedded software. You know, all these different areas of software give you the flexibility to use a really wide range of languages and tool chains, and teams pick the ones that are best for them, for the problems that they're solving, for the particular development culture that they want to be part of, whether it's functional programming or scientific programming or really low-level programming for embedded devices or whatever. People pick what is best for them, and that's good and healthy and mature. But web development has always lacked that a little bit because we've been so constrained over, you know, basically everything has to be JavaScript or has to be something that compiles to JavaScript and has more or less the same semantics as it. So I hope that web development as a discipline will be able to grow up and mature a little bit and give teams a much wider set of choices that meet their needs in specific ways. And so .NET, I hope, is just one of the forerunners of that.
Yeah. We hear a lot about browser monoculture, and we're getting into language monoculture. With WebAssembly, we could have Go and Rust and C# all running in the same, you know, application, and then interoperating, yeah. You know, with JavaScript as that service bus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I know some people will hear that and they'll think, oh my goodness, I'm now supposed to learn 10 new languages. This is going to be a nightmare. And I can somewhat sympathize with that perspective. But if you think about what developers building mobile apps or, you know, scientific apps or machine learning apps that run across cloud services, they don't really complain that there are too many languages. That's not really a thing that software developers do. Normally, they find things that work well for them and become good at it and establish their career within a particular technology area. And I hope that that would be the case for web development as well, and not that it just becomes this nightmarish mishmash of 20 different languages that you're meant to know. And I don't see any reason why it would be. You know, web development can become like other aspects of software development.
Hey friends, this is Scott. You know, listening to podcasts is a great way to keep up to date on technology, since we're always learning as software people. And you can also find a job by listening to a podcast if you check out our new sponsor, Hired.com. That's Hired.com/HanselMinutes. On Hired.com, software engineers can get interview requests from companies that want to hire you. Each offer will have the salary and the equity up front. You can view those interview requests and, you know, accept, reject, change the offer before even talking to a company. It's a great way to find out what's out there and maybe make a move. They're working with over 6,000 companies, from startups to large companies, from 14 major tech hubs throughout North America and Europe. What's great about this is it's totally free for software engineers. And if you get a job through Hired.com, they'll ordinarily give you a $300 thank you bonus. But if you use our special link, they'll double that bonus. So you will actually get paid $600 when you accept that job. Now, if you're not looking for a job, but you know someone who is, refer them to hired.com/Hanselminutes, and they'll give you a lead bonus, a $1,337 bonus, when they accept a job. So check them out at hired.com/Hanselminutes. Now, recently in the last few years, .NET went from being a thing that runs on Windows to being a thing that runs everywhere. And it seems like there are multiple instances of .NET.
Yeah.
Where the .NET framework is a.NET and the core CLR is a.NET. And then Mono is around there as well. And some people in the past may have felt like Mono like wasn't a thing that was going to be around for a long time, but they've been quietly and very strongly like improving Mono. It's a very competent runtime. It's not a toy. It's not buggy. It's really solid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There was a time when people thought Mono was this sort of semi-capable way of running ASP.NET on a Linux server. And that was kind of the only application that anyone had in mind. And then they tried it and they found that things were complicated and they would say, oh, just don't do it. And so some developers have ended up getting stuck in this idea that that's all that Mono is. But in fact, like you say, Mono has really expanded to become a very competent runtime that runs on the widest range of devices of any of the .NET runtimes. And in particular, Mono is the runtime for the Unity game engine, which runs some of the most demanding high-performance, low-level, and generally complex .NET logic there is. And it has to run on a wide range of devices. That, you know, the performance is super critical. And Mono has been very successful in that for Unity, particularly on iOS and Android. And speaking of mobile apps, Unity is also the Microsoft-supported runtime for general native apps, even not games. So Xamarin, which is part of Microsoft, uses Mono as its runtime for delivering native mobile applications. And yeah, like you say, it's very robust these days. It's very complete in its support for the .NET API surface. And generally, it's part of Microsoft. It's solid and it's going well.
Yeah, yeah. The way I've been describing it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that you know, core CLR runs on a half dozen Linuxes and Mac and Windows, and it's really focused on that that server side workload, that microservice. But Mono is just very portable C code. It compiles anywhere. I've seen versions of Mono compiled for like the Nintendo Wii, or you know, like it is the most portable of the .NETs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
So as such, did you then compile it into WebAssembly? And is that what's coming down? I'm running Mono as a .NET in my browser compiled into WebAssembly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Mono is the runtime that's behind Blazor applications. And the reason why we are going with Mono is that it is, like you say, the most portable of the .NET runtimes and the one that was most ready to be compiled to WebAssembly. Now, I didn't do that myself, and no one on the Blazor team did it. But this is something that the Mono group has committed to delivering. They've decided that Mono is going to ship on WebAssembly, and that's a general decision that they've made about making their runtime available independently of Blazor or any specific application stack. And they've got lots of reasons for wanting to do that. But one of them is related to gaming. Again, like I just mentioned, Mono being the Unity runtime. Unity also has shipped the ability to compile to WebAssembly for a while, and they've done that based on their own separate mechanism for compiling .NET to WebAssembly. But Mono, since that is going to officially support WebAssembly, is going to provide a different way of doing that that is significantly simpler. And then there is potentially lots of other reasons why Mono wants to target running in the browser for applications in general. So yeah, that definitely makes sense for why we would choose Mono as the runtime for that. The other most likely option, I suppose, would be CoreRT, which is a different .NET runtime that is designed for for running on low resource embedded devices. And maybe one day Blazor might run on CoreRT as well, but it's not particularly close right now. because CoreRT is as much less complete developed WebAssembly support.
Mm-hmm. What if I have a browser that doesn't support WebAssembly, but it does support JavaScript? Will it be possible to run Blazor and .NET on that?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So one of the very nice features about how WebAssembly was designed and probably reflects the decade of experience that we've finally got in designing new web specifications is that WebAssembly is designed to be easily able to fall back on regular JavaScript. So WebAssembly is a bytecode format, like I've said, and if your browser doesn't know how to support it directly, it's possible to polyfill it. So you can have a relatively small bit of JavaScript that knows how to execute WebAssembly. So it's acting like an interpreter over the WebAssembly. But there's an even more direct way of running WebAssembly, which is the way that the WebAssembly compilation toolchain itself works. So most of the time when people create WebAssembly binary files at the moment, they do so using a compiler called mscripten. And that is part of the Clang toolchain. Now, Clang is a very widely used system for representing applications such that they can be compiled to different target architectures. So you could take some code that's written in C++ or Rust or Swift and compile it to a Clang intermediate representation, which is a virtual machine bytecode format called LLVM. And once you've got the LLVM bytecode, you can compile that out for lots of different target architectures like x86 or ARM or MacO or all kinds of other things like that. And the mscripten toolchain, which what that actually does is it takes input in this LLVM intermediate representation and writes that out as WebAssembly. So that's really a hidden internal part of the compilation process. But one cool thing that it can do is, as well as producing WebAssembly binaries, it can produce JavaScript files, .js files, that just run in any browser without needing any special WebAssembly support. So it's just a different compilation target format. A lot of people have said JavaScript is the assembly language of the web, and I think, Scott, you were one of the first people who popularized that thing. And that is literally the case for mscripten, acting as JavaScript being a target output format for LLVM bytecode. And so in the case of Blazor specifically, we have got two versions of the Mono runtime that are embedded into your application. We've got a WebAssembly version of it, and we've got an ASM.js version. ASM.js is the plain JavaScript representation of the WebAssembly output. And so what we do when your application is starting up, we just do the classic thing of feature detection. We detect whether the browser currently that's running supports WebAssembly. If it does, we'll load the Mono WebAssembly runtime. And if it doesn't, we'll load the Mono ASM.js runtime. And then your application just carries on and works. And everything is the same. The only thing that's really different is performance. And there's a fairly substantial performance gap, probably at least about 5 times performance difference between the WebAssembly and the JavaScript versions of the runtime. But, you know, your application still works, even if the browser doesn't support WebAssembly.
Mm-hmm. The .NET standard is an agreement, a list of APIs that are a way for you to say, oh, my runtime, my .NET is .NET standard compliant and can run all of these kinds of things. But underneath, when you write .NET code, we p-invoke, we platform invoke into native stuff. So I can just arbitrarily call a function on a DLL and make my computer beep. Yep. If I wrote some C-sharp code to load up, you know, win32 whatever .dll and call beep and then upload that into Blazor, yep, what's going to happen?
Well, it's not going to work, that's for sure. I'm not certain I can guess precisely what the error message is going to be. It would probably be something like file not found, which just seems a bit surprising. But I think something like what would happen is that the .NET runtime would say, oh, you've got a p-invoke to a particular DLL, and then it's going to go out to the file system and try and find that DLL. But because it's running within the browser's sandbox, what it's going to see is not really the files that are on disk, but a sort of virtual file system that mscripten creates at runtime, and it will look for your DLL there, and it's obviously not going to be there. And so it's going to fail at that point.
I see. So if I write portable code, if I write code that doesn't have a lot of native bindings, that isn't Linux specific, that isn't Windows specific, like business logic code or calculations and stuff like that, it's going to work great. Yeah. But then if we up-level it, Blazor is also a framework to design UIs, but it's not like Silverlight, right? You're not painting buttons and stuff. You're on the web, so you just do web stuff. We just write HTML.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Blazor is trying to provide a .NET way of writing your application logic and conventions around structuring the application that are productive and tie in with what C# developers expect. But Blazor is not trying to replace the actual UI presentation layer within the browser. So Blazor applications still use HTML and CSS. And maybe 5 years ago, or 10 years ago at least, that might have been a dubious choice. But I think over recent years, CSS has become pretty effective at representing typical application UIs. Things like Flexbox and CSS Grid and all that kind of stuff has largely eliminated the sense that CSS is lacks suitability. And now CSS is generally a very productive way of representing application UIs. And HTML, obviously, going with that. So we didn't feel there was any need to try and replace HTML and CSS. And certainly when we talk to developers, although there's a passionate minority who do want us to get rid of CSS, certainly the majority feel pretty happy with it and are just excited about using .NET to replace the logic that they would otherwise have written in JavaScript.
How opinionated is Blazor? Is it opinionated to the point where you would just use Blazor by itself, or would you use Blazor with React or with Angular or with Knockout?
You definitely shouldn't have to use a different JavaScript UI library like Angular, React, or Knockout. Blazor provides all of the stuff that you would need from your single page application framework. So Blazor applications are written with a combination of C# and Razor files. Now, Razor, most listeners will know about, but for anyone who doesn't, Razor is a syntax for generating HTML from the middle of C# logic. So it's somewhat akin to, I don't know, let's say JSX for React developers or Angular templates, but really it very closely matches what C# developers are looking for. And it's a pretty well-established syntax. So in Blazor, each one of your Razor files is a component in the same sense that you have Angular components or React components or Knockout components. So it's a self-contained bit of user interface, and you can structure your whole application out of a collection of components. You can do all kinds of things with them, like pass parameters in and get callbacks from them and derive subclasses of them and all that kind of stuff. So components are a very flexible pattern for building an application. And our intention is that Blazor provides all of the infrastructure that you're going to need. So as well as components, related infrastructure like routing and validation and just all those kind of details. So hopefully you don't need to deal with the mismatch of trying to write, say, a React application, but in C#, because there'd be all kinds of reasons why that would be messy and difficult, and it would be difficult to represent all of the kind of semantics that React expects within C#. We don't want that kind of awkward mismatch. So we've created an application framework that's really tailored to C# as a language.
Mm-hmm. So as of the time of this recording, this is an experiment in that you are kind of collecting feedback or hoping that the bosses at Microsoft will say this is a great idea and then put a team on it?
Yeah, exactly. Both of those things. I'm hoping that we're coming up too close to our experimental phase and we might be able to make some announcements about that. But those decisions have not been made yet, to my knowledge. It's looking good, though. We've had some very, very positive response from the community. We've collected lots of data about how great people say it is. And I'm feeling fairly optimistic that we'll be able to build a product out of this. And depending on when people are listening to this podcast, hopefully there might be some news about that, but not as of the date of recording.
Okay. And people can check this out. I think the website is Blazor, BLAZOR.net. And it's pretty easy to get started. And it works anywhere. Works on Linux and Windows and Mac. And you just do it in Visual Studio Code, I suppose, eh? Or do you need Visual Studio proper?
Well, that's One of the things that we definitely want to improve on, if we build this into a real product, at the moment, the best tooling is definitely in Visual Studio on Windows. And we've started there because we had a lot of expertise with doing Razor there. Razor support in VS Code in general is a bit limited right now, but it's definitely our hope that we would bring a complete tooling story cross-platform with VS Code. It's not there today.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I wish you all the best. I think it's a pretty exciting project, and I've presented it at local user groups and stuff. So I'm going to do my best to go out and spread the word.
Excellent.
And I hope that people check it out at blazor.net. Thanks so much. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.